baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
So here we are. It is Christmas Eve, and Adam and I have been kind of teasing this over the last week. What we decided to do for our wrap-up is kind of go through our interviews from the last year and pick our favorite stories. By the way, welcome everybody to the walk-off. I'm Scott Belford, joined by Adam Mack. And over the last 18 months that this walk-off community has been kind of forming and growing, we have had some incredible guests on the show. Like, literally mind-blowing guests. And I was kind of going through them and picking out stories, and it even excited me. And one of the things with our guests is we sit down with them for these 45 to 60 minute chunks and really deep dive into baseball. And thank you very much to anyone who's ever clicked on a link or watched in entirety. That's very impressive. But what we're doing is we're clipping these, so that, like, some of the best 6-7 minutes, a little bit more digestible, if you will. Obviously, you can follow us on Twitter at Walk Off Podcast, on Instagram, The Walk Off Podcast. Adam runs the Twitter, and we both ignore the Facebook, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much.
Stop pretty teasing much. Facebook, Scott, if you're ignoring it, right?
Yeah, but exactly.
All right, so we'll leave it at that. We're going to intro all of these clips as we go. Hope you enjoy. Thank you so very much for following along over the last year. Cheers.
Hey guys, this is Tim Mays with the Toronto Blue Jays, and you're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
It was actually really cool in the spring to get to sit down and chat with Tim Mays. Of course, he made his major league debut in 2018. He played with the Jays in 2019, and then he went into Tommy John surgery. And man, like, he sat down with us for an hour.
Pretty cool.
Left-handed pitcher, and he became one of the highest leverage guys in this Blue Jays bullpen in 2021. He was literally indispensable. He was great with his time off the out of spring training with us. He talked about his Tommy John recovery. He gets into everything in his career. But this particular clip that we're about to play for you, he gets into Pete Walker and what he did for him and just the kind of guy Pete is, and as well as his MLB debut. Enjoy. So I want to talk Pete Walker with you for a second here, because he just seems to have this ability to connect with pitchers and tweak little things and figure out a game plan that works best for him. I'm curious what your experience with Pete has been as your pitching coach, and if there's been any little tweaks or things like that that he's given you that has increased your pitching acumen over the years.
Mm-hmm. No, Pete's great. You know, obviously he has a wealth of knowledge that he's able to offer. And I think even more so, he's a great communicator. He knows kind of how to connect with pitchers, how to communicate with pitchers, you know, and it's definitely a gift, because each pitcher kind of communicates a little differently or works a little differently. So for him to be able to kind of do that with each guy is definitely special. You know, for me, he's been able to, you know, kind of go over some repertoire stuff and some pitches that he feels are most effective, and, you know, just make little tweaks here and there, and maybe some delivery stuff that he's seeing, or, you know, sit down and break down some video, and here's why, you know, that pitch got hit in particular, or here's what I'm seeing, this is where you're most effective, and this is where, you know, your strengths are, and just stick with it. No, he's been great in communicating, and been great in kind of matching, you know, what you do well and how to, you know, take advantage of that.
So with stuff like video sessions and analytics and stuff like that, have you had, I guess, an aha moment where they're showing you something or showing you the data on a pitch that you use that maybe you didn't even realize how effective it was? And then they're like, well, look at the numbers, and you're like, okay, well, I'm throwing that more.
Yeah. Just kind of over the past couple of years, I would say that has happened. You know, coming up, I was always kind of a four seam slider guy. threw all four seam fastballs, didn't matter what side of the plate, and just and threw sliders, and now it's kind of become more of a two seam game with me, where that pitch has become kind of effective and pairs well with my slider, and that has progressed over the past 2 years, where I've seen some positive results, and the data was kind of backing that up. So to continue to progress to where, you know, I throw a lot more two seams now than I do four seams, where in the years past, I wouldn't even throw a two seam. I wouldn't even think about it. But it's just, okay, this pairs well with your off speed and your slider. So you continue to progress with it. And, you know, I've been seeing some positive results over the past few years with that two seam.
It must be so weird to work so hard at something and then maybe something, like you said, like the two-seamer that just was an afterthought, all of a sudden you're like, wait, this makes me so much better, and I wasn't even really working on it. Like,
Yeah. And it was something, you know, I just wanted to dive into, like something like, hey, how can I create movement to the other side? I don't really have a changeup. I don't have anything that kind of runs arm side, and everything I did, you know, my four seam had maybe a little bit of cut at times, and my slider and everything moved that one direction. So I just wanted to take a chance on something that, how do I get movement the other way? And it turned out to be to have a positive impact and be a positive addition to my repertoire.
Yeah. That's great. Just to get another pitch that'll dip down the other way. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about August 14th, 2017. That is the day that you were called up to the big leagues, and then you pitched in your first major league inning the next day. That must have been one hell of an experience. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, anybody's debut is going to be like, whoa, you know, kind of like, oh man. No, I remember, you know, vividly kind of, we were on a bus back from Toledo to Buffalo, back to Buffalo. And, you know, I was on a different bus from Bob Stanley Steamer, our AAA pitching coach at the time. And, you know, he calls me and says, hey, like, you're going to the big leagues. And I'm like, oh man. And so get called to the front of the bus, and it's like, hey, you know, I had to keep it quiet at the time, which is completely understandable. You know, when there's a move like that, there has to be another move, unfortunately.
Right.
So that's kind of the thing. And, you know, as much emotion as you may have and excitement, you have to like not show it at all. So, while inside you're just bursting out with excitement, you on the outside, you're kind of just like, oh, just a phone call, you know?
Oh, that would be so hard, man. It would be like, today's Christmas, but only you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was obviously able to tell my parents and told, you know, the important people, you know, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, I was able to tell her, just so they can kind of prepare, you know, flights and stuff like that, because those are the people you kind of want there, when you debut.
Yeah, of course.
But even it was, you know, so the next day I got there and it was crazy, because even at the, you know, I'm good friends with Chris Rally, and he was up there at the time. He made his debut maybe a week earlier, but I didn't even tell him. I was like, I can't tell you. And that, you know, I walk in and he got all mad because I didn't tell him, but
that's awesome.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it was super exciting and to, you know, be able
must
to
have
do
been
that.
So validating too, eh? Just after all of that work and like having that singular goal and to accomplish it, it must have just been like, holy crap, it was all worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you think about other sports and it's, you know, your first rounders are usually up right away, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, your top picks in the NFL, your top picks in the NBA are kind of impact players from the start, or at least getting playing time at the highest level from the start, where baseball, you know, you kind of have to climb the ranks a little bit and it takes a while. So I think it makes it that all that much more validating that, hey, you worked this hard over this many years and you had to go through this many levels to get to this moment. And, you know, it's always a goal. I think of every player and every person is like, you know, even in the backyard as a kid, you're kind of being like, oh yeah, 3-2, two outs in the World Series. Like, just are like doing that moment of being in the big league. So,
yeah.
To actually do that was very validating and, you know, special.
This is Taylor Saucedo with the Toronto Blue Jays, and you are watching the Walk Off Podcast.
Really cool having Taylor Saucedo on the show this year. We set up an interview with him just before he got called up, actually, and then he got the big
call up. Yeah, when he was still with the Bison.
Was all apologetic, like, oh, I'll still, whatever, like, I still want to do the show, but, you know, I got this thing that's going on with my career, and we're like, oh, no, I guess that's fine. You know, good luck with your major league debut, but, you know, probably within a week or two after his debut, he was able to make some time for us, and we sat down with him for, what, 45 minutes or an hour? And
yeah, it was a great talk, yeah.
Really cool, like, deep conversation. I mean, he talks about how just the year before he was like literally quit baseball. He was like come to kind of the end of his path and was had come to terms with the fact that baseball was maybe over for him.
And he'd then, let the team know, he let his parents know, like yeah. He literally had quit before he was talked out of it. So that's kind of where we'll go with this. You know, and you just turned 28 too, so you know, like Adam and I were talking before we hit record here and you joined us, just like what a battle it is to stick with it till you're 28. You know, like a lot of guys would have already given up, man. Something to be said there.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually kind of crazy. Not a lot of people know this. During the pandemic, and everything leading into this season, I was, you know, I had a talk with the Blue Jays and, you know, they told me some things and my realistic shot as to get to the big leagues wasn't great.
Yeah.
So I actually was like, you know what? I think it's time that I focus on the next career of my life, the next phase of my life. And so I texted some of the guys. I told my parents I was actually done with baseball.
Wow.
Yeah, I was done, but I talked to one person and he knows, it was Sean Taunt, old coach of mine. And I told him, cause he was opening up his facility for me to throw at. And I told him, I was like, hey, you know, thank you for working with me and helping me out, but, I'm done. And he texted me back and he was like, hold on, I want to talk about this. I'll call you tomorrow. I was like, okay, calls me tomorrow, calls me the next day. And he was just like, look, man, I know who you are. You have to fill out your contract. You're going to go down the road 10 years. And you're like, man, like, I really regret calling it early. He goes, just fulfill the contract. And if it doesn't work out, You played 7 years of professional baseball. Like, not many people can do that, but just see it through. I think you have a lot left in you. And I was like, and he, you know, we went over some few things, like personal things. And he was like, just do this. Like, and he's like, you owe me at least. Like, I want to be there for a game. And so I was like, okay, fine. I'll do it. You know, like just because we had that moment together and he's never shared some of those things. So I was like, all right, I'll do it. And here we are.
That is unbelievable, wow. Taylor. I can't even get over that you were that close to hanging it up.
Yeah, it was literally. If I didn't text him, I'm probably in class right now somewhere.
You owe that guy a lunch or something, hey?
Now he, I called him that day when I got the call. Like, I called him and I was like, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow?" And he was like, "Are you joking me?" Like, I didn't even get into what I was
doing. He just knew.
I was like, "Do you want to go watch a game at Fenway tomorrow?" And he was like, "No way!" Like, just losing it. So,
that is amazing, dude. So in the last 3 weeks, you've had your MLB debut, your first major league strikeout, your first high leverage runners in scoring position situation as a big leaguer. And I know that high leverage situation maybe didn't go exactly like you wanted, but man, how big is it acquiring these experiences and these firsts, right? Like, you're a guy who's come up through the system. You just talked about it. 7 years as a pro, or you're approaching it anyways. You've been promoted before. Getting these firsts out of the way, does it kind of help you become comfortable and confident at a new level?
Yeah, 100%. You know, and like, you go out there and you go and face and you get that first outing out of the way, that helps, and it goes well. Obviously, that helps. That builds up the confidence. And then you go out for your second one and, you know, and you do well. And then you run into your first sort of, you know, struggle. And so I would say 2 out of 3, you know, in my first big league career is pretty good.
Yeah,
and
man.
Stuff like that's going to happen, but you know, it's just the trick with baseball is to have that short-term memory, whether it's good or bad. And so just having that and going out there, and now I got it all out of the way, right? I had success, I failed, you know, and so just having all of these experiences now, it's good because it sets you on the right path. Now it's like, okay, I got it out of the way. I know what went wrong, you know, and so, you know, it's been good.
That's great, man. I know you kind of mentioned how excited the Bison's teammates were for you. You've played with a lot of these guys at some point in the system too, here with the Jays. Like, yeah. Did you have a certain comfort level going into that clubhouse, and were the guys pretty excited for you there too?
Yeah, it was a lot of the guys, like majority of these guys I played with, like Vladdy, Bo, Romano, and so on, Kevin, and so you name it. And like, I hang out with these guys and I text them all the time. And so just like now being back and like being with them, like one of my also good friends is Patrick Murphy. And, you know, we were sitting in Baltimore and we were like, did you think that we would be in Camden Yards, like sitting here together? Like, there's no way I would have thought that. Like, there's just no way. And so, you know, just having these guys here and like being with them, it's definitely has made the transition pretty easy.
Hey, this is Pat Henkin with the Toronto Blue Jays. You're listening to The Walk-Off with Scott and Adam.
One of the biggest thrills of the year is definitely getting to talk with Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Pat Henkin, just a Blue Jays legend. And the fact that he took 45 minutes out of his day to talk baseball with us is still very thrilling. It was super cool. So we actually did get into 1992, him winning those World Series and his Cy Young win and winning 20 games. This is the clip. Enjoy. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, it must have been kind of surreal to go from, and I'm not downplaying it, but from a minor contributor on a stacked juggernaut team that was the 1992 World Series Toronto Blue Jays to literally a major contributor in 93's World Series victory, where you were an all-star, you won 19 games, you won a game in the World Series. Like, at 24 years old, did you truly comprehend what you were accomplishing?
No, heck no. No, as a matter of fact, in 92, I was so nervous pitching, it was ridiculous. I couldn't get comfortable coming out of that pen. So when I went into spring training in 93, another shot at being in the rotation, we had signed Dave Stewart that offseason. And I'm like, man, oh man, you know, now that bumps me back to six. So me and Leiter go into spring training and we're battling it out. And Al had a better spring than me. And off to the pen I went in April. And Dave Stewart got hurt, I think, one of his first or second starts in Seattle. And I filled in for him, and I won like six or seven games in a row. And then when Stu came back, Leiter went to the pen. And that's how that whole went down. I mean, you got to grab the opportunity. You know, Cito gave me the opportunity in a championship-type caliber team and gave me the ball every fifth day. You know, you just did your best to try to take advantage of that. And then, you know, I think in baseball, it's one of those sports where if you don't continually try to get better, people are going to come and catch you.
You kind of brought up wins for a second there, just because in the 90s, wins was such a big stat. Like, pitching stat in baseball just seems to not put the same sort of emphasis and stock on wins that it used to. And that said, don't get me wrong, 20 wins is still a lead in today's game. But in the 90s, wins reigned supreme. Like, the pitcher stock piling up wins were the most sought-after pitchers. How big was it for you in that 1996 Cy Young winning year that you hit that 20 mark? Because you were at 19 in 93. You were very close. Like, was 20 significant to you?
Yeah, I mean, in order to win 20, you need a lot of things to happen. First, you need offensive support. Second, you need a good bullpen behind you that don't blow games. I know the one year I think I left was with the lead seven times and got no decisions. So you can't have that type of season. You can't have that. And I wasn't going five and fly. I mean, I was going like six, seven innings every time.
Yeah.
And so those things happen. And unfortunately, you always say to yourself when you're in the locker room watching, man, I should have just finished the game. You know, if I had enough pitches, you know, that was the only thing I could really fall back on was get all 27 outs instead of complaining that your bullpen couldn't get you six outs or they couldn't get you five outs. But yeah, it's funny how they don't really focus on the wins. I think at the time in 96, I came down to the stretch. I remember there was a month to go in the season and we were playing the Orioles and Messina, who I really looked up to. He was really set the bar in my era. I said, Moose came out and pitched a great game in Toronto. And then he came out and said, oh man, Henkin's stats are better than Pettit's and that he's the front runner. That really made me feel an extra boost of confidence when I needed it.
Yeah.
And it came from an opposing player who was playing the same position as me that everybody in the American League looked up to because he was one of the most elite, consistent pitchers in the era. And for him to come out and say that was pretty darn cool. And then the last month went, and Mel Queen was a pitching coach, and he said, you know, we can massage this rotation maybe and get you an extra start the last day of the year, but you got to pitch on 3 days rest on your next start. So that was an easy decision for me. I said, okay, so boom, we did that. Well, lo and behold, I got my 20th on the last day of the year.
Wow.
Yeah, Brady Anderson led the game off with a solo homer. And then I ended up going, I think, 7 innings. I think we won the game 3-1. And Spoljarek and Timlin came in and cleaned up my mess late in the game, and I got the win. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like, man, what's funny is about that year you won the Cy Young that I remember is how strong you came on after the All-Star break. Like, I think you won Player of the Month in July and August. And like you just said, like, last game of the year is when you got that 20th win. Do you remember that post-All-Star game stretch? Like, looking back on your career, those 2 months, did you feel like it was the best you'd ever been or just the best you'd ever executed? Or did it even stand out to you as anything more than just part of the season?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, 96 is a year I didn't make the All-Star team, but I won the Cy Young that year. Yeah. It's kind of strange. And, you know, the second half, you're right. I think I went like a bunch of starts in a row where I was going 6 or 7 innings, and I had a bunch of CGs in a row 1 month. You know what? You just get into that confidence where your physical attributes and your mental all kind of come together at the same time. And that's kind of what happened at that range of 94, 5, 6, 7. There was a nice 5-year stretch I had in Toronto where it was like physically I felt really good and strong. And mentally, every day I just got better at becoming a better pitcher, learning how to self-coach. And I think that coming down that stretch on the road, I pitched a lot better on the road as a Blue Jay. You know, I don't know if anyone knows that, but my splits were better on the road.
Toronto's, what do you think that was?
Oh, Toronto's not a pitcher-friendly park.
Well, I mean, yeah.
That was. I mean, you know, the ball flies. Guys love hitting there. The hitting eye is fantastic. All the hitters love hitting there. The ball carries. There's no wind. When I played, it was a hard turf. This newer turf slowed the ball down a lot for the pitchers. So I think
not
it was just
kind of those bouncing doubles into the corner, right? Yeah.
Right. I give up a ball between the shortstop and second baseman, and it went all the way to the wall. Now go figure that one. That's how fast that surface was. Now, don't get me wrong. The guy crushed the ball. I mean, ball was probably 110 miles an hour. But, I mean, it was just hard to fathom that it could get between the two middle infielders and still sneak to the wall. It was fast back then.
Hey, this is Stubby Clapp, first base coach with the St. Louis Cardinals. You're listening to The Walk-Off with Scott and Adam.
One of my favorite guests this year that we had was Stubby Clapp, just a staple of Canadian baseball.
Legend.
Legend. Really cool getting to chat with him for about an hour. Of course, base coach with the St. Louis Cardinals right now. Maybe my favorite story of that whole interview, though, was him telling us about his draft experience. And without getting into any spoilers, let's just get into it.
But you did bring it up there. What was your draft day like? Like, what was that?
I had no idea. I had no idea what it was. I had no idea what the Major League draft. That year when I was at Texas Tech and we played in a regional tournament, to go to the World Series. And, right before the tournament, coaches called me into the office. And, when they called me into the office, I was like, why am I being called in the office? We're getting ready for a major tournament. I haven't done anything wrong. You know, I've kept my GPA up where it needed to be. You know, I haven't done anything stupid off campus. You know, I was like going through everything negative in my head.
I love that. It didn't even occur to you that he was, yeah.
Absolutely no idea. You know,
what did I do wrong?
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, I get in the office and it was Coach Hayes and Emo and Frank Anderson, which I'll give him a shout out. He's at University of Tennessee and they just qualified for the World Series. So congratulations to Frank Anderson and University of Tennessee. They sit me down and they're like, hey, we gotta talk to you about something. And I was like, oh man, what did I do? Like, I can't even think of what I did wrong. Like, I tried to be the model guy, you know, the model teammate, the model student, and you know, everything. And they're like, if you get drafted, are you gonna go? And I was dumbfounded by the question. And I was like, sir? I'm Canadian. I can't fight for your army. And the whole office erupted. All three coaches erupted. They're like, no, we're talking about the major league draft. And I'm like, you mean like professional baseball? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, I had no clue what they were talking about. They're like, seriously, you don't know what you're talking about. I was like, no, I have no idea. I was like, I don't know. They're like, well, we've got word that you're going to get drafted to go play professional baseball. We've got to replace your position. We've got to replace you with somebody if you're going to go play. And I'm like, I have no idea. He goes, you haven't talked to anybody? I was like, no. I was like, I've talked to nobody. They're like, well, listen, we got word and you're going to get drafted and this and that. And I was like, well, can I think about it? Like, yeah, just get back to us. Let us know. So, you know, I thought about it. And at that time, I was really unsure. I mean, I had no idea. So, I was going to go, and I thought I was going to finish my degree at Texas Tech. And that was my whole idea. So then when the draft does come, I was told I was going to go in the top 10 rounds. And I thought that was kind of a little bit high. I didn't know like where I stood or where I compared to anybody else, but I know how I stood in the Southwest Conference at that time. And so I didn't pay attention to all that stuff. I just didn't get into stats. I didn't get into who's who. I just played. I just played because I was having fun, and someone was going to pay for my education, my thought process. So I was going to try and be a doctor by the end of it. So, so when I did get drafted, or they said I was going to go in the top 10 rounds, I sat around by the telephone for the first day of the draft and I didn't get drafted. I was a little upset or whatever. And the next day I was like, I'm not sitting here. So I went to my brother's practice with my dad and helped them out and watched, kicked around some balls with them and stuff like that. And, sure enough, by the time I got back, I got drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals in the 36th round. And my mom's like, the St. Louis Cardinals called. A gentleman said you got drafted by them in the 36th round. He wants you to give him a call back. I was like, who? Who did I get drafted by? And so I didn't know. You know, at that time, I knew who the Toronto Blue Jays were, and I knew who the Detroit Tigers were, because that's where
I love this story.
Absolutely had no idea who the St. Louis Cardinals were. And I called the gentleman back, and you know, I had an advisor at the time, and of course he gives me the offer. He's like, yeah, we'll give you $1,000 and a plane ticket to come to extended spring training and, you know, get you over here and get you going. And I was like, well, I asked him, what about school? Can you help me pay for the rest of my school if I give up my scholarship? Cause I had a full ride at Texas Tech at the time. And, he called me back, whatever, you know, an hour later, he's like, sorry, we got rid of all of our education money already. And, you know, $1,000 is all we have. So I tried to call my advisor. Of course, he's nowhere to be found. He was dealing with all his big draft picks or whatever. So, of course, I had to make the decision on my own. And I was like, $1,000, that's not going to get me very far, but I'm tired of studying right now.
Yeah,
I had already put 4 years into university. That's including the 1 year in Montreal. And so I made the decision right there. I actually had plane tickets to go play in the Alaska Woodbat League. I was supposed to go play in Kenai, Alaska, and I had plane tickets in one hand and being drafted in the other hand. And I had to make a decision. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go play professional baseball. So I made my decision right there. And that was all she said after that.
Hi, this is Sean Green, former Blue Jay, and you're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
Blue Jays legend, Sean Green, truly a comparable, him and Carlos Delgado in the 90s, to Bo Bichette and Vladdy Guerrero right now with the Blue Jays. How they were the young studs coming up in the system, were tied at the hip, loved each other, and kind of came up through the system together. And Sean actually sat down with us and chatted for almost an hour. It was such a thrill to talk baseball with the man. And we talked about that 1998 team that maybe is one of the best Toronto Blue Jays teams ever assembled, and how dynamic they were and how close that he felt that they were to actually being a championship team. Without further ado, we'll get right to it. Let's go back again. 1998. And I honestly, man, it's so funny as a Jays fan. I still think about that team. I still think it might literally be the best Jays team of all time, which I know sounds crazy being they won the World Series in 92-93. And it kills me that that 98 team finished third in the AL East. I mean, my goodness, man, you look at that pitching staff, Roger Clemens. And let's put Roger aside for a second, because Kelvin Escobar was absolutely phenomenal that year and doesn't get enough credit. Chris Carpenter, you became a household name around Canada, stealing 35 bases, hitting 35 bombs. Carlos Delgado, Jose Canseco, like literally the offense was insane. How good was that 1998 Blue Jays team?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I was doing an interview at one point a couple months ago, and you know, I think that was the best team that I was on, and I think that team, that was the best Yankees team that year, I believe, like in 98, I think was their best team, and I really think they were praying we didn't get to the postseason, because I feel like we swept them in September in, you know, maybe in Yankee Stadium, but we had their number, and we just didn't realize how good we were until about, I would say probably July or August. And all of a sudden we were cruising the second half of the season. Like you said, you know, Clemens won the Cy Young, but Carpenter and Escobar, I think, were better pitchers the second, you know, last 2 months of the year. So we had those three guys, like, to have a short series and face those three guys. And then don't forget the last day of the season, Roy Halladay came up and almost threw a perfect game, right? No hitter with two outs in the ninth. The only guy that reached base that day was an error. So, I mean, he basically, you know, came out and gave us a foreshadow of, you know, what he was going to be about. The other thing about that team is we had Shannon Stewart, you know, raking and stealing bases. So we had speed. I mean, Canseco stole 29 bases. As you said, I stole 35. I don't know. And Shannon stole a bunch. I don't know how many he stole. So it was, we had power, we had speed, we had the starting pitching. Our bullpen was our only area that wasn't rock solid. I mean, we had Quantrill, who was, you know, great. But that was the one area that was maybe a little shaky. But that said, you know, I think in a short series in the postseason, that team goes really far.
So that is 98 one of those years that you look back on and you're like, huh, that's too bad. That was a close one.
Yeah, but I think it was coming out of, you know, the previous 3 years, we were never in the mix, right? 95, 6, and 7, we were, you know, we had some good talent, but we had some gaping holes in those teams. And all of a sudden, 98, I think sometimes it just takes a beat for you to figure out, wait a second, we're actually really good. And you play with that confidence. Like I said, if there was 10 more games, I think we go to the postseason. We got knocked out on the last Friday of the year, you know, season ending on Sunday. So we got knocked out on a Friday, and, you know, 10 more games, you know, we go to the postseason, and, you know, I think it'd be really interesting at that point.
Yeah, no, I remember that year so well. And I remember even getting knocked out and just being so excited that, you guys just turned it on so much at the end of the year, you know,
exactly.
Like it really went from thinking that, you know, it could be another 1997 to all of a sudden being like, wow, this team is legit. So,
yeah. And it was a really fun team, because, you know, the older guard had left. And so now it was all of a sudden, you know, it was our team, the younger players. And, you know, granted, we had, you know, some legendary veterans there, like Canseco and Clemens and guys like that, but really the heartbeat of the team was the young core that we had, which, you know, a lot of people were excited about the young core, but we were sort of being suppressed, you know, for a few years, and then we kind of had, all of a sudden we took over, and that was the culture of the team. If you remember when everyone dyed their hair blonde, and, you know, there's all these like, you know, it was just a fun team.
Yeah, well, I know, and it's funny, man, because I was a big fan of yours in that era, you know, like I was 16 and I was just like, yeah, Sean Green's going to take us to the promised land. And I was just looking up your numbers and I had forgotten like how dominant, like 1999, man, you had a monster year in every aspect. Like, and I mean defensively too, gold glove in the field, right? Like silver slugger award, 42 dingers, 45 doubles, 123 RBIs in your first all-star appearance. It was kind of your coming out party as an elite player in the league. What was that experience like to kind of become the star of the team? And do you remember things about your first all-star game appearance?
Yeah. So so for me, 98 was when I think I, you know, the first time I got a chance to play every day, and I had a manager that believed in me. I had veteran players like Canseco and Clemens that were, you know, kind of making comments to me throughout the year that, that how much potential they thought I, you know, how they thought I was going to be, you know, a really good player. So that to have guys that I had posters on my wall as a kid, believing me, have a manager now that's playing me every day, hitting me, you know, second or third in the lineup. It was just a different mindset, right? So going into 99, I had 98 behind me and had kind of taken it to the next level. And so 99, it's kind of a strange spring. You know, Tim Johnson got fired and they brought in Fregosi. But Fregosi, same thing. He believed in me. When I got hit by a pitch against Andy Pettit and broke this little bone right here. And, you know, he was just crushed. And to have, you know, a manager that wanted me in there so badly. And, you know, I was like begging on it, just don't put me on the DL. The doctor said it could be, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks. So don't put me on it. And so he didn't put me on the DL. For me, I think it's, you know, I would get from kind of that point on, I would get really streaky in my career. And that year was the one time. Yeah, other than maybe the first week or 10 days of the season, I basically was hot, you know, most of the year. Yeah, I had a July. I think I had hit every game in July. I had like a 28 game hitting streak, and that's just kind of how I became a hitter. That once I kind of found that groove, then I would get locked in. And for some reason, that year just lasted much longer time than other years. And you know, I had great hitters around me. Homer Bush was hitting ninth, hitting 300, stealing 40 bases, whatever. And Shan Stewart's leading off. So every time I'm up to bat, I got some guys a threat to steal on base. I'm getting more fastballs, and I got Delgado behind me. And then Tony Fernandez had hit 400, you know, up to the All-Star break, basically.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a really great mentor. And he, you know, he taught me a lot from spring training on, just taught me a lot about hitting. So I was really comfortable. You know, I loved a lot of the coaching staff. Like Gary Matthews was a hitting coach. He was awesome. Jim Lett was, he threw batting practice to us, and Carlos and I had a lot of fun in batting practice and started, you know, trying to compete against each other, hitting home runs to center field. That's kind of, you know, all that stuff kind of added up together. And when you're really comfortable and you're feeling good, it's a lot easier to perform. And so then you asked about the All-Star game. Yeah. So I was, when I got hit by that pitch against Pettit, that was early June. And, you know, I was, I think, second in league in home runs at the time and hitting 320, 330, something like that. So I was feeling like, oh, I'm a shoo-in to make my first All-Star team. And then all of a sudden I break this little bone in my hand. And then, you know, I was pretty devastated. Obviously, I didn't want to miss any games, but also that was kind of lurking because it was getting close to All-Star game. I ended up missing about 2 weeks, tried to play after a week, came back, and, you know, got hot pretty quickly and had a good little stretch, and then ended up making the All-Star game and went to Boston. And it was pretty incredible because at Boston, it was 1999, so it was all the best players that were still alive of the century, really the history of baseball, right? So getting a chance to meet Ted Williams and, you know, see Willie Mays and all these players was, you know, as a guy who grew up a huge fan, like that was, you know, that was definitely the ultimate.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jamie Campbell, host of Blue Jays Central. You are listening to The Walk-Off with Scott and Adam.
Another great guest that we had this year. Anybody who's grown up watching sports in Canada knows Jamie Campbell. And, the young boy inside me just had absolute goosebumps when we got to sit down and chat with him. Here's a fun story that he talks about giving back to baseball and sports in general. Really cool little story here. Enjoy.
Understand that one of the gifts of working in baseball is that there's a very consistent Blue Jays fan base. Whether they're, you know, that fan base increases dramatically when they win, and when they don't win, it's very stable and very, very loyal. And those people are always going to be there, and they're always going to be relying on that ball game on their television every night or on their mobile device. And I recognize that those people are the people that essentially keep me employed. and they know that when they turn on their television, I almost become like a family member to them, and I want to treat them as such. And that's why the freedoms in the off season give me that chance to reach out. And it just so happened that, you know, the first time we encountered this pandemic, as you guys well remember, the season didn't start until the 24th of July, and we ended up playing 60 games. So I had what are normally baseball months with nothing to do. And that's why I just decided, let's get active here until they restart this season in some way. Let's get active and get out there and see what we can do to help people improve their lives.
Absolutely. So both Adam and I are stand-up comedians, and I know I was just in Saskatchewan this weekend as entertainment for some Christmas parties, right? I was actually in Moose Jaw on Thursday, and I met Corey Olofsson. He's the general manager of the Moose Jaw Miller Express men's baseball team, and of course the organizer for their big charity Kinsman Sports Banquet, which you personally have been involved in numerous times, which is a very cool aspect of your job. I was very curious when he was talking about all of the speakers that you have worked with. What are some of the best storytellers when it comes to professional athletes that you've run across? And have you done any of these banquets where something happened that still kind of stands out to you?
I've done lots of them. And I hope you enjoyed your time in Moose Jaw. It's a fascinating place. And Corey's a wonderful, wonderful man. Despite all we're going through right now, they're still going through with their fundraiser in February, which shocks me, but that's Saskatchewan, right? It's a little different there. I have managed to drag a lot of Blue Jay players to Moose Jaw in particular. There was one year that stood out, not by anything that, that was said or done or generated a bunch of laughs. But it was funny. One year I convinced Devin Travis to come with me, and it just so happened that it was about the coldest month on record in the history of South Saskatchewan. And he and I got off the plane, and he'd never, ever seen – this is a guy from South Florida. He'd never seen snow. And as we're walking off this plane in Regina, to see his reaction to snow, something he'd never seen in his life. He'd heard about it. He'd seen it on TV. He'd never actually experienced it. It was absolutely amazing. So it is fun to take guys who are normally accustomed to warmer climes. Joe Biagini came with me one time, and he had the room in tears, as you may well imagine. I wish Joe had been able to foster a longer, more fruitful major league career, because his gift of the gab is extraordinary, and it would just enhance his profile as a major league baseball player if people knew how stupidly funny that guy is.
This is really crazy, Jamie, because I've got a great story to kind of add on to yours. So the year you were in Moose Jaw with Devin Travis, I was actually playing the comedy club in Regina, the Laugh Shop at the time, and my brother, just over my shoulder here, you see a picture of R.A. Dickey. So my brother came down when I was living in Toronto, and we went and saw R.A. Dickey, and he had one of his like midsummer, just incredible games, you know, when he like allows three hits over seven innings or whatever. So my brother got me this for my birthday, and I was flying to Regina and had to have it on as my carry-on. And I did the show, and I was flying out back to Toronto Sunday morning, 5 a.m. And I'm in line, and I've got this picture with me. And all of a sudden, there's a guy behind me who goes, "Hey, nice picture." I turn around, and it's Devin Travis, and we just like, what?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
So I've got a picture with Devin and us holding up the R.A. Dickey.
That's great. That's amazing. That would explain that.
we talked the same thing you just brought up. He was just like, what the hell is winter here? This is insane. So
yeah. I took John Gibbons there one winter, about two or three winters ago.
He must have just been like the celebrity of the year there, eh? He's so folksy.
people loved him. You know, it was an eye opener for me. One year we did an event in Saskatoon, and I went with Kevin Pillar and Chris Colabello. And this was the off season after the Blue Jays had won the American League East in 2015. So their popularity was at reasonably high.
An all-time high, yes.
and what I didn't realize is that Kevin Pillar is a fascinating individual to speak to, but Chris Colabello has this edge. And when you get the two of them together, they bring out the very, very best in each other from a sense of humor. And boy, those two had the room on fire. It was amazing to watch.
What's up, guys? This is Adam Klovenstein with the Toronto Blue Jays, and you're listening to The Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
We were so lucky to have some of the Blue Jays' top prospects on the show throughout the year. One of the first ones to sit down with us was King Klov, Adam Klovenstein, and he kind of talked about his experience throughout the pandemic. Of course, minor league was shut down for all of the guys who were within the organization and weren't big leaguers participating in that 60-game season. So Adam Klovenstein performed and pitched for the first time with big league guys in what he calls the COVID League, which was the Roger Clemens Constellation League. And he kind of gives some background on that and his experience with that. Enjoy.
I watched Springer face for you, and first pitch, Springer took a hack that if he barreled it would have landed in your backyard. I think that guys are ready to go. And I think that's a good sign.
There, and you sort of touched on it too, there must be so much transferring of information going on right now. And I love that you kind of brought up that you were into hearing what Springer had to say about your pitching and stuff. Because that was one thing when we talked to Joey Murray that he really brought up about, I know you weren't there, but he was at the alternate site. And that was one of his biggest growing experiences, right? Was that he couldn't stop talking to hitters. He's like, I've always picked pitchers' brains, but he's like, just being around big league hitters and hearing what they're seeing just meant so much. It must just be so prevalent right now everywhere you go, eh? Guys just like picking each other's brains.
Right. Yeah. And that was when I played in that COVID kind of league that I played in. And
I want to hear all about the Constellation Energy League. Yeah. Let's get into it. Yeah, buddy.
So that one, I kind of same as Joey, you know, I was facing guys that were, you know, I faced a couple guys, more than a couple guys that had got drafted before I was born. And like they had originally, there was a couple guys that had gotten drafted in like 1998, 1999, you know, yeah. Stuff like that. And they had been in and out, you know, of the league. And, you know, obviously these aren't Hall of Famers, but they're guys that have been there. They're guys that have competed at the highest level in the world. And they're guys that have, you know, made plenty of money doing it. And, you know, I think that, you know, facing hitter and every hitter I face for the most part had at least double A experience, which I still have never pitched in a full season yet. So facing, you know, I one thing I learned a lot was like, it doesn't matter who you are, how good you are, how much money you got, who your dad is, you know, all that stuff. Experience is like gold. And when you can find people that have experience, you know, I don't care if, you know, somebody's coming up to me with a doctorate from Harvard, he never played. Like, I want to talk to somebody who has been in those games, who has been in a stadium with 40,000, who has pitched in the playoffs, you know, who started a game seven. You know, I want to talk to guys like that, and, you know, and talk to hitters about really when they've been up there where I want to be, when they've faced guys that are household names, what they saw in those guys that other guys don't do, what they saw in those guys that made that pitcher be able to get them out 9 times out of 10. And, you know, so I think that, you know, being around guys like that, I faced a couple of guys that grew up in the area that were, you know, I had heard their name and they were getting drafted and they were like first round picks when I was like 12, and I never imagined pitching to them, you know, and it just starts to come a little bit more real. And that's, you know, that's the same thing with, like, you know, you watch.
Let's stop for 1 second here for the listeners who don't know. So we're talking about the Constellation Energy League, which was kind of, it was four teams, correct? And it was kind of thrown together because there was no minor league ball to try and get some experience for
correct.
You guys.
Correct.
And Roger Clemens was actually, this was kind of his brainchild, right?
Yes. Roger Clemens was the head engine on that train.
Unreal, man. That must have been, you've met him obviously with him.
Yeah. So he was actually in my dugout for pretty much every outing I had. He's a really, really smart guy, good guy, really wants to, you know, he just has, I mean, I'm assuming you've come across people in your life where it's like every word that comes out of their mouth is just gold. And I think that, and you just stop what you're doing and you listen, because like I talked about with that experience component, as far as pure experience goes and performing at the highest level, as far as still living, he's about the best you have. He pitched for 24 years at the highest level, 7 Cy Youngs, has faced everybody and their brother. And, you know, I think that, you know, talking to him, he threw a bullpen for us. He's still throwing like upper 80s. Like he is just, the biggest thing to me that's
upper 80s. My God. Yeah.
He still throws he still throws batting practice to his kids, but he throws like competitive batting practice. And he was talking about, you know, he still tries to strike his kids out, and like that competitor in him that obviously I'm a little too young to remember, but I know you remember that competitor in him is still there. And he would get pissed off when we would lose. We were playing a round robin 28 game league. No one really won the league. Like no one really cared. And he would get mad when we would lose. He was still has that competitor side. And if not, you know, he's playing golf all over the country, you know, and getting mad when he's not playing golf well and, you know, stuff like that. So, and the funniest part is, you know, he was still doing like his arm care and his stuff after he threw, you know. And the biggest thing that stands out to me about him that over anything else, over almost more impressive to me than the Cy Youngs and the all that kind of stuff, is the longevity and never going under the knife. That is nowadays, if you told the Blue Jays, Adam Klavenstein is going to pitch for you for 20 years and he's not going to win one Cy Young, but he's going to be a solid 2 or 3 in the rotation starter, and he's going to give you a solid outing 9 out of 10 times, and he's going to do it for 20 years, they'd give me $300 million right now. Because that is what is most sought after from teams, is someone who's consistent. And that's not just when they're pitching, they're really good. That means they're consistent every day. They're consistent in everything that they do. And I would be the first to say that not going under the knife and never being really truly injured in 24 years, there has to be some luck involved in that. But
obviously,
but it's just extremely impressive to me. And obviously that era that he pitched in, you know, when you talk about Nolan Ryan and some of these guys that, you know, Nolan Ryan's made it very clear and apparent, you know, that how he disagrees with some things that go on nowadays, and guys are soft and all that stuff, which a lot of people are soft. I agree with that. But, you know, I think that, you know, what those guys were able to accomplish and never being injured, I mean, it's really, really cool to see and really fun to hear what they have to say about it, because, you know, you can hear like, maybe some trainer that worked with Roger Clemens for 6 years, or, you know, somebody that coached him for a while or whatever. And they're telling secondhand stories about Roger, but he's standing here telling me about striking out, you name it. He's, you know, he's talking about facing Barry Bonds. He's talking about facing Ken Griffey. He's talking about facing these guys that is just like
legends.
It's like you're watching a movie. It's like, you know, and so it was really cool. And, you know, it was a really fun experience, but kind of going back to what Joey was saying, it's a lot like that, where I was trying to be too fine at the beginning of it, because all these guys and I wouldn't say I was necessarily intimidated. I was just going at it from a logical perspective, as these guys right now, most of them are probably I don't know if I would put it as better than me, but they have more experience. So my stuff is nasty to a short season guy, but this guy's seen 20 of me in his career. So I'm trying to be too nasty. I'm trying to make them look stupid and fall over rather than throwing the ball over the plate, making them hit it, you know, letting my stuff do what it does. And I had a couple guys, you know, kind of sit down with me after some of my outings, and they were, you know, they're like, "Hey man, your stuff is really good. Your stuff is, I was 19 at the time too, when I was pitching in that. And they're like, you know, your stuff is something that I might see in a big league spring training game. So throw it over the plate and make it do what it does. Don't try to, you know, you don't buy a Lamborghini and then try to make it even fat. Like, just do what your stuff does."
Here's Sam Roberta of the Toronto Blue Jays, and you're watching the podcast Walk Off with Scott and Adam.
Sam Roberta was one of the cooler guests that we've had on this year. Of course, what is he, 19 years old, Scott?
Young kid, that's right. And he's out of the Netherlands. He was an international draft or signee, if you will.
Right. Very cool. I think he's a top 10 prospect for the Blue Jays this year. Had a great 2021 season for us. Fun little chat. We had some good questions about how big baseball really is in the Netherlands. Of course, that's where he's from. So he kind of gets into that, his experience interacting with the players from the Netherlands who have made it to the big leagues, and just kind of how cool they are with imparting wisdom to, you know, the next crop of young talent. Enjoy.
Yeah, I've had that sometimes where, like, I don't really throw my changeup to right-handed hitters. I don't know. I just don't have that much confidence in it for some reason. And then I was kind of struggling. It was a pretty long at bat. And then all of a sudden my catcher just calls a changeup. And first I'm like, no changeup to righties. And then he puts it down again, and I'm like,
so
well, the rest
it off, and then he put it down again. I love it.
And he put it down again, and then just to like mix it up and see what it does. And because I've thrown my curveball, my slider, my fastball, fouled it off, and stuff like that, and just mixing it up, and I throw it, and we get out of it. And certain things like that is really good, and that is what you get from talking to your catchers and throwing bullpens to them, and they understand what the pitch does, what helps, and what your thought process is, also from experience from games before, and then just mixing it in there, knowing like, okay, just mixing it up, and like, yeah, that helps sometimes. And that's really, really good feedback also for yourself within the game. Like, okay, I can throw this pitch too whenever I get in trouble, when I usually don't really throw it. So yeah, that's a really good learning moment.
I know last time we talked, Sam, in the spring, you mentioned mm-hmm. that the pitch you were feeling the best about was your fastball. You had put some velocity on it from the year before. You were feeling good with it. You had a good feel for it. What pitch were you liking the most come the end of the season? Was it still the fastball? And what pitch was working best for you? And is there a pitch that you put a lot of work into improving that you kind of felt good about by the end?
I started throwing my slider in spring training. And that was kind of like a up-down relationship with it within the beginning of the season, and really trying to work on it, finding a way to make it consistent and make it feel comfortable. And then I found a way to do that. In the beginning of the year, it was more like fastball, curveball. And then I developed that slider even more, and that felt a lot more comfortable than my curveball, since it was a little slower and my slider was a little faster, and I was able to play it off my fastball a little better. So by the end of the season, I definitely thought my slider was a good pitch to like get even bad contact or swing some misses, and then my fastball could play off of it if I wanted to like speed some guys up. And when my fastball had enough ride to it, which sometimes I kind of like lose whenever I have a little cut to it, but whenever I have the ride to it, I can get swings and misses with it, and I can always, pretty much locate it where I want to. So I still want to say like my fastball feels the most comfortable, but my slider is definitely second pitch that I can throw for a strike and strikeout pitch in almost any count now, so that feels very comfortable.
It's kind of funny how improving one pitch can make another pitch so much better, like how you were touching on there, that as your slider improved, it did make your fastball a bigger weapon against the guys you were facing. Does the curveball and the changeup do the same sort of thing? Like the slider more mimics, or I don't know how your slider is, I haven't seen it, but does your slider more mimic your fastball, or is it like, is what are you throwing when you're trying to completely throw a guy off? Are you going off speed, or are you kind of leaning on that slider more and more?
I think it is more like the sequencing part, like how you set a guy up and how you attack him. I try to, like, of course my fastball is straight and then my slider goes off this plane and the curveball goes down and then the changeup goes off this way. So they give kind of like this and then down. So, depends on what the hitter is looking for, or what he's swinging at, more like fastball wise, because hitters are always trying to, hit the fastball most of the time. And, to see like, okay, he's trying to go, he's looking for outside fastball. He's looking outside, out over the plate. Then, you know, okay, I can get swings and miss with it. Swings and misses with it, with a slider if it's a right-handed batter, or a changeup if it's a left-handed batter. So you kind of like work your way around it, how you want to set a guy up and attack a guy. And yeah, when I have my four pitch mix, it's definitely an advantage for me.
Okay, so for the podcast, we have a Discord, it's called. And basically, it's just like a hangout digital for the listeners, where everyone's just chatting Blue Jays and prospects and stuff like that all the time. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that we were bringing you back on the show here, and we actually had quite a few listener questions for you, which we will get to. But we had like this long thread about the Dutch island of Curaçao. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea how many major league players come from this island. And as this thread got longer, everyone kept bringing up the same sort of question. So maybe you can shine a little enlightenment on for this, us ignorant Canadians, I guess we'll put. Mm-hmm. do players in the Netherlands, like, do they look at Curaçao as counterparts, or is there like a rivalry? Are you playing on the same national team? Are they their own thing? How does that kind of relationship between these, how does it work?
it's not a rivalry. I mean, they're playing on our Dutch national team. It's called Kingdom of the Netherlands. So the kingdom includes Curaçao and Aruba, and I think Sint Maarten is in there too. There are multiple islands that we include in the Dutch national team. So it's for sure not a rivalry. In the WBC, we have a lot of players from Curaçao that play in the big leagues right now, like Kenley Jansen and Andrelton Simmons, Xander Bogaerts, Ozzy Albies, Jurickson Profar, all those players. And they definitely help us get through tournaments like that. We made it to the semifinals in the last WBC. Like, that's a huge accomplishment,
of course.
Oh yeah. So they definitely help us. So it's really cool to see those players combined with our players from the Netherlands and like working together as a group and making it that far in tournaments like that. So it's a really cool connection.
And some high profile guys too, to kind of look up to and learn from. Very cool.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, for players who were ex-professional, who only played in the minor leagues and go back to the Netherlands, who like grew up there, and they're able to play with big leaguers like that, and they can still learn things from them to make, to improve their careers within the Dutch national team, and still look up to them and talk to them and like share their lives, like how different it is. And I think that's a really cool, cool conversations that go on there in the clubhouse and stuff.
What's up, guys? This is Zach Logue, left-handed pitcher in the Toronto Blue Jays organization. You're listening to the Walk-Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
Lefty starter Zach Logue actually got called up to AAA Buffalo in midseason last year, and he sat down with us. Of course, he is now on the 40-man roster, and even just the fact he is a lefty and is so close, been pushing that major league envelope, we might even see him in a Blue Jays uniform in 2022. And what was really cool about the conversation with Zach is that he really kind of got into his personal life a little bit more and touched on his girlfriend and kind of the fact that he played hockey growing up and in college. So enjoy the clip. It must have been pretty cool this spring training coming back. Was it kind of like a reunion of sorts? Like, yeah, it's like, oh my God, we're all still here.
Right. Yeah. Cause we, you know, you keep in touch with a few guys, but there's definitely some guys that you hadn't talked to in a while and definitely hadn't seen in about a year. So you get back and it's almost like the first day of school. You're back together with all your good friends and you're out there just playing baseball again. It was a lot of fun.
So Zach, you are only 6 feet. Now I say only 6 feet is not short.
Right.
My goodness, dude, in comparison to some of the guys in the organization, you must feel like you're surrounded by giants sometimes, right? Like it's 100%. A tall pitching crew.
100%. Especially here in Buffalo, we got TJ Zoik, Nate Pearson, Jacob Wagsback, Brian Baker. Those guys are all, you know, 6'4" plus. And then there I am walking around at 6 foot. And like you said, 6 foot, you know, it's not
You've
short.
Never been short till right. now.
Right. But then I look in the locker room and I'm looking up at everybody. It's kind of crazy.
Well, buddy, it was so funny because we had Fitz Stadler on the show last month, Fisher Cats pitcher, former teammate, right? And of course, he's 6'9", so he's probably the tallest of the bunch. And I got a real kick out of him because we were just talking about who he tries to image himself after, sort of thing, like what pitchers he watches. And he was like, in all honesty, man, like my biggest thing is staying compact. And so he always envisions himself as in a Marcus Stroman avatar. He's like, I get on the mound and I'm like, think small. Like,
That's funny. If I were him, I would have never guessed Marcus Stroman, but I mean, he's obviously a good guy to, you know, emulate after. He's athletic. Course. He moves super well. And if you can, you know, get close to that, you're probably doing something right.
Exactly. So do you have somebody that you kind of see similarities into how you pitch and kind of model yourself after a little bit, or see similarities in?
Yeah. I guess more in high school, I kind of like looked at John Lester a little bit. Oh, nice. I really liked the way he competed on the mound. You know, he's kind of stoic out there, not super
fellow
high energy,
lefty, right?
Yeah. Fellow lefty. Exactly. He doesn't throw super hard, but he has unbelievable command, great competitor. And so I just kind of like the way he went about his business.
Nice. So Zach, you're engaged, correct?
Correct.
Nice. Congrats, correct. Man.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I'm a stand-up comic and I'm on the road a lot. So I kind of see similarities in the pro ball players. Right. And I know my fiance, super supportive and really gets kind of the time commitment needed.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, like I said, ball players similar, right? A lot of travel, a lot of being on the road, definitely, and away from home. How important has that support from your girl been? And has having someone in your corner helped you?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And yeah, like you said, I got to give a shout out to her. Her name's Kayla. Her birthday was yesterday, actually.
Hey, nice.
Happy birthday to her. But yeah, it's awesome to have somebody that understands the time commitment, like you said, understands kind of what you need to do to take care of your business. And yeah, she's been awesome. She's always there to, you know, talk about the game if I want, there to take my mind off the game if I want. Does a great job.
A bigger part of it than people give it credit for, isn't it? Just like
totally
having some actual alone time, some 100%. Time where it's just like just you, and you don't need to be involved in the game or whatever it is, right?
Exactly. Sometimes, you know, whether it be after a good game, tough game, sometimes you just want to come home, you know, kick your shoes off, watch TV, hang out, not think about it, get away for a while. And having somebody that understands that is definitely huge over, you know, a 6 month full season.
That's great, man. How did you two meet?
We actually met in high school.
Okay.
So we've been together for, I guess, over 10 years now. We met in high school. I actually played hockey in high school. And one of her friends was dating one of my teammates. So we got introduced that way. We've been together for quite some time now.
This brings up
so
many questions.
Well, that'll endear you two Canadians' hearts.
Is hockey big in Louisville?
What position did you play in hockey?
So I was a center and a left wing. I played left wing most of my life. And then when I got to high school, I kind of transitioned over to center. And to answer your question, I grew up in Cincinnati. I wouldn't say it was huge in Cincinnati, but I had a friend, his dad's name is Sean Williams. Actually, he played hockey growing up. He's Canadian. I think he played a couple games with the Blackhawks, but he played like a long time and with the Indianapolis Ice and stuff like that. So got introduced to his son, Blake, and played hockey with him from probably like second grade up until high school. Cool. So yeah, I had a little bit of a hockey career, I would say.
That's really cool.
Were you a good hockey player?
I like to think I was pretty good.
Was there
I played,
a decision to be made? Like, did you lean towards baseball just because you were better at it, or?
So kind of funny story. So I went to like a public school for elementary school and stuff like that. And then when it became time to choose where I wanted to go for high school, I could have continued with the public school, or there is a private school, Moeller High School, where I ended up going. And Moeller had a varsity hockey team, and Mason, the public school, did not. So I wanted to play varsity hockey. So that was really like one of the big decision or factors in making my decision to go there. So, yeah. But, I love hockey. I love watching it. I haven't skated in a long time, but I still love to watch it. And it just kind of became apparent that baseball was probably going to be the future if I wanted to pursue something in college or beyond.
Hi, guys, this is Anthony Telford. You're listening to The Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
Friend of the show, Anthony Telford, we've had on probably three times at this point.
Three times now, yeah.
Of course, he is, I guess, known to us as Nate Pearson's personal off-season pitching coach. Been with him since he was like 14 years old.
Yeah, pitched with the Expos in the 90s for 4 years.
Yeah, he was a teammate of Vlad Sr. So many cool stories from Anthony Telford. Hard to choose just one. But, I mean, you and I both hate the Yankees, so it was nice hearing him also express his hatred for the Yankees.
He really hates the Yankees, yeah.
So he fits in great here. This is a fun little story about his first experience in New York. Enjoy.
And I'm an American League East guy and a National League East guy. I can't stand the Yankees.
Well, you're the first I've ever heard to say that.
quick. Do you got time for a story?
Yeah, lay it on me, please.
Okay, first start in Yankee Stadium, my rookie year, 1990. Going through the minor leagues, the Yankees I'd never lost against any Yankees team at any level. So A ball and double A, I beat the Yankees every start, and being an Oriole, that was a lot of fun to do. So fast forward, I get my, I get a start against the Yankees in Memorial Stadium, and I go like 6 2/3 or something like that. Kevin Moss and Matt Noakes hit back-to-back home runs off me in the seventh, and we lost, I think it was 2-1. So that was the first time I'd ever lost against a Yankees team. So fast forward to the end of the year, Frank Robinson calls me in the office. I started in A ball. I went to double A. I was like 14-4 in the minor leagues. I got called up to the big leagues. I was 3-2 with like a 2.8 in my big league September-ish call up, late August, early September call up. And I threw the ball pretty well. I had maybe one bad start against the Seattle Mariners where I went like 4 or 5, but all the other starts were pretty solid. So Roland Heyman, the general manager, and Frank Robinson are back in Frank's office, and they call me in the office, and Frank goes, hey kid, you know, we're really proud of you, but we want you to go ahead and sit down. We're going to give some other guys the ball for the end of the year. You've pitched, you know, a bunch of innings. And I argued with him. And I said, no way, I'm pitching against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium. They beat me last time. Like, I got to go beat them. And he goes, and so I get in this conversation with Frank freaking Robinson. And I'm 24-year-old kid, and I won't shut my mouth, right? So Frank looks at Roland and goes, Roland, looks like the kid's not going to give the ball up. And he looks at me and goes, okay, we'll give you one more start. So just to you guys out there, if a Hall of Famer is telling you what to do, you freaking do it. You don't argue with them, okay? So we go into Yankee Stadium. We take the train from Baltimore to New York. So my wife Christine came. She came. So we're all on the train. We get off the train. Now, I've never been to New York. I'm a California guy, right? So I'm this laid back California guy. And we go to New York City. So I get off the train. And we're walking and we go to some taxi stand or something. And I see, I'm looking to see what everybody's doing. That way I can do it, right? Look like a big leaguer, got my trench coat on, got my little briefcase with all my stuff. Cause that was fun back in the day. We all had, you had to get a briefcase. That's what you got, a briefcase. So I have my suit on and my trench coat and my briefcase and my wife's with me and I'm standing in line and I'm watching this guy like run out into the street, get a cab, and then come back. And I'm watching the guys, everybody's tipping the guy $5, $10, whatever it was. So the rookie in me, when they gave me my meal money envelope, I just grabbed the money, folded it, and put it in my money clip and put the clip in my wallet. Well, I had folded the money, large bills out. So I had like hundreds and 50, hundred, couple of 50s, whatever the meal money was for the week. I can't remember how much it was, but it was probably a couple hundred dollars in there. Right. Which, by the way, was about half of my minor league pay for a month, you know? So I had some cash. So we get to the cab and I go to look down and I pull my money clip out and I take it out. I take the bills out. And I look up and the guy's staring at me and I go 100 and I go 50, whatever. So I'm trying to flip and get to a five or whatever.
Yeah.
And the guy looks at me, he looks down at my hand and he tries to snatch my money. He peeled out a 50 and he just took off running down the street. So I immediately start screaming at him. I'm chasing his ass down the street. I'm like, if I get my hands on this guy, I'm going to rip his neck off. And he runs out into traffic and runs away. And everybody's screaming at me, yelling, don't chase him, whatever. And so 5 minutes in New York, I got robbed. Okay. We go to, I'm pitching that day. That's my day. I'm starting. We go to the hotel. I'm hot. People are looking at me on the street. I'm like, what are you looking at? I was so mad at everybody. So we go to the stadium. Blah, blah, blah. We do the warm up, all that. I'm in the bullpen warming up for my start against the New York Yankees. And I got hit in the head with a C battery. A C battery hit me in the head while I was pitching in the bullpen.
Someone threw it into the bullpen.
Somebody threw a battery at me and hit me in the head. It cut me. I got a little cut, a little blood.
Oh.
So I'm like, it knocked my hat off. I'm like looking for my head. I'm like, what the hell? I pick up the battery. I look up. And the security guards in the stands are just waffling this guy that threw the battery at me. So I'm like, well, at least he's getting beat up for hitting me in the head with a battery. So now I got robbed.
Yeah.
I got hit in the head with a C battery.
Yeah.
C battery. And now I got to go pitch against the New York Yankees. So the first guy, Roberto Kelly, hits a homer. The next guy gets a hit, dogmatically gets a broken bat hit. I don't even know what happened. But there was two guys on in the first inning. I gave up four straight hits and Frank Robinson took me out of the game. So I went from 3-2 with like a 2.8 to 3-3 with a 4.95 ERA from my audition. I'm sitting in the dugout in Yankee Stadium wondering what just happened. And a guy named Mickey Weston, one of my very good friends, came in for relief and the first pitch he threw got hit out. So they cashed all my runs. So no innings, six hits, six runs, all earned, no walks, no strikeouts was my last inning of 1990.
Oh my God.
So that's my Yankees. So when I say I don't like the Yankees, I got reason. Like I don't freaking like the Yankees.
Yeah. Well, I don't like the Yankees and I don't even have any stories like that.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Oscar with a drive. Cheese and crackers. Chose to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.